clinic before we were born. You can check that with her. Yeah, so? To cut a long story short, I'm suing the clinic for $10 million, and I'd like you to join in the suit with me. There was a thoughtful pause. I don't know if you're for real or not, buddy, but either way, I don't have the money for a lawsuit. I'll pay all the legal costs. I don't want your money. So why are you calling me? Because my case would be strengthened by having you on board. You better write me with the details. That's the problem. I need you to be here in Baltimore at the Stouffer Hotel tomorrow at noon. I'm holding a press conference ahead of my lawsuit, and I want you to appear. Who wants to go to Baltimore? Like, it's not Honolulu. Get serious, asshole. You have a reservation on the U.S. Air flight out of Logan at 9:45. Your ticket is paid for. You can check with the airline. Just pick it up at the airport. You're offering to split $10 million with me? Oh, no. You get your own $10 million. What are you suing them for? Breach of implied contract by fraud. I'm a business student. Isn't there a statute of limitations on that? Anything that happened 23 years ago. There is a statute of limitations, but it runs from the time of discovery of the fraud, which in this case was last week. In the background, a Hispanic voice shouted, "Hey, Hank, you got about 100 customers waiting." Hank said into the phone, "You're beginning to sound a little more convincing." "Does that mean you'll come?" "Hell no. It means I'll think about it after I get off work tonight. Now, I have to serve drinks." "You can reach me at the hotel," Steve said. But he was too late. Hank had hung up. Jeannie and Lisa were staring at him. He shrugged. "I don't know," he said frustratedly. "I don't know if I convinced him or not." Lisa said, "We'll just have to wait and see if he shows up." "What does Wayne Statner do for a living?" "He owns nightclubs. He probably already has $10 million. "Then we'll have to pique his curiosity. Do you have a number?" "Yes." Steve called it and got an answering machine. "Hi, Wayne. My name is Steve Logan, and you may notice that my voice sounds exactly like yours. That's because, believe it or not, we are identical. I'm 6'2", 190 pounds, and I look exactly like you, except for hair color. Some other things we probably have in common. I'm allergic to macadamia nuts. I have no nails on my little toes, and when I'm thinking, I scratch the back of my left hand with the fingers of my right. Now, here's the kicker. We're not twins. There are several of us. One committed a crime at Jones Falls University last Sunday. That's why you got a visit from the Baltimore police yesterday. And we're meeting tomorrow at the Stouffer Hotel in Baltimore at noon. This is weird, Wayne, but I swear to you it's all true. Call me or Dr. Jean Ferrami at the hotel. Or just show up. It will be interesting." He hung up and looked at Jeannie. "What do you think?" She shrugged. "He's a man who can afford to follow his whims. He may be intrigued, and a nightclub owner probably doesn't have anything pressing to do on a Monday morning. On the other hand, I wouldn't take a plane on the strength of a phone message like that." The phone rang, and Steve picked it up automatically. "Hello? Can I speak to Steve?" The voice was unfamiliar. "This is Steve. This is Uncle Preston. I'm putting your dad on." Steve did not have an Uncle Preston. He frowned, mystified. A moment later, another voice came on the line. "Is anyone with you? Is she listening?" Suddenly, Steve understood. Mystification gave way to shock. He could not think what to do. "Hold on a moment," he said. He covered the mouthpiece with his hand. "I think this is Barrington Jones," he said to Jeannie, "and he thinks I'm Harvey. What the hell do I do?" Jeannie spread her hands in a gesture of bewilderment. "Improvise," she said. "Gee, thanks." Steve put the phone to his ear. Yeah, this is Steve," he said. "What's going on? You've been there hours." "I guess so. Have you found out what Jeannie's planning to do?" Yes, I have." "Then get back here and tell us." "Okay. You're not trapped in any way, are you?" "No. I suppose you've been fucking her." "You could say that." "Get your goddamn pants on and come home. We're all in bad trouble." "Okay." "Now, When you hang up, you're going to say it was someone who works for your parents' lawyer, calling to say you're needed in D.C. as soon as possible. That's your cover story, and it gives you a reason to hurry. Okay? Okay, I'll be there as fast as I can. Barrington hung up, and Steve did likewise. Steve's shoulders slumped with relief. I think I fooled him, Jeannie said. What did he say? It was very interesting. It seems Harvey was sent here to find out what your intentions are. They're worried about what you might do with the knowledge you have. They? Who? Barrington and someone called Uncle Preston. Preston Bark, president of Genetico. So why did they call? Impatience. Barrington got fed up with waiting. I guess he and his cronies are waiting to find out so they can figure out how to respond. He told me to pretend I have to go to Washington to see the lawyer, then get back to his house as fast as I can. Jeannie looked worried. This is very bad. When Harvey doesn't show up, Barrington will know something's wrong. The Genetico people will be forewarned. There's no telling what they might do. Move the press conference to another location, step up security so we can't get in, even cancel the event altogether and sign the papers in a lawyer's office. Steve frowned, staring at the floor. He had an idea, but he hesitated to propose it. Finally, he said, "Then Harvey must go home." Jeannie shook her head. "He's been lying there on the floor listening to us. He'll tell them everything." "Not if I go in his place." Jeannie and Lisa stared at him, aghast. He had not worked it out. He was thinking aloud. "I'll go to Barrington's home and pretend to be Harvey. I'll reassure them." "Steve, it's so hazardous. You don't know anything about their life. You wouldn't even know where the bathroom was. If Harvey could fool you, I guess I could fool Barrington." Steve tried to sound more confident than he felt. "Harvey didn't fool me. I found him out." "He fooled you for a while. Less than an hour. You'd have to stay there longer." "Not much. Harvey normally returns to Philadelphia on Sunday evening. We know that. I'll be back here by midnight." "But Barrington is Harvey's father. It's impossible." He knew she was right. "Do you have a better idea?" Jeannie thought for a long moment. Then she said, "No." 59. Steve put on Harvey's blue corduroy pants and light blue sweater and drove Harvey's Datsun to Roland Park. It was dark by the time he reached Barrington's house. He parked behind a silver Lincoln Town Car and sat for a moment, summoning his courage. He had to get this right. If he was found out, Jeannie was finished. But he had nothing to go on, no information to work with. He would have to be alert to every hint, sensitive to expectations, relaxed about errors. He wished he were an actor. "What mood is Harvey in?" he asked himself. "He's been summoned, rather peremptorily, by his father. He might have been enjoying himself with Jeannie. I think he's in a bad mood." He sighed. He could not postpone the dread moment any longer. He got out of the car and went to the front door. There were several keys on Harvey's key ring. He peered at the lock on Barrington's front door. He thought he could make out the word Yale. He looked for a Yale key. Before he could find one, Barrington opened the door. "What are you standing there for?" he said irritably. "Get in here." Steve stepped inside. "Go in the den," Barrington said. "Where the fuck is the den?" Steve fought down a wave of panic. The house was a standard suburban ranch-style split level built in the 70s. To his left, through an arch, he could see a living room with formal furniture and no one in it. Straight ahead was a passage with several doors off it, which, he guessed, led to bedrooms. On his right were two closed doors. One of them was probably the den. But which? "Go in the den," Barrington repeated, as if he might not have heard the first time. Steve picked a door at random. He had chosen the wrong door. This was a bathroom. Barrington looked at him with an irritated frown. Steve hesitated for a moment, then remembered he was supposed to be in a bad temper. "I can take a piss first, can't I?" he snapped. Without waiting for an answer, he went in and closed the door. It was a guest bathroom, with just a toilet and a hand basin. He leaned on the edge of the basin and looked in the mirror. You have to be crazy, he said to his reflection. He flushed the toilet, washed his hands, and went out. He could hear male voices from farther inside the house. He opened the door next to the bathroom. This was the den. He stepped inside, closed the door behind him, and took a swift look around. There was a desk, a wood file cabinet, lots of bookshelves, a TV, and some couches. On the desk was a photograph of an attractive blonde woman of about 40, wearing clothes that looked about 20 years out of date, holding a baby. Barrington's ex-wife? My mother? He opened the desk drawers one after the other, glancing inside. Then he looked in the file cabinet. There was a bottle of Springbank scotch and some crystal glasses in the bottom drawer, almost as if they were meant to be concealed. Perhaps it was a whim of Barrington's. As he closed the drawer, the room door opened, and Barrington came in, followed by two men. Steve recognized Senator Proust, whose large bald head and big nose were familiar from the TV news. He presumed the quiet black-haired man was Uncle Preston Bark, the president of Genetico. He remembered to be bad-tempered. You needn't have dragged me back here in such a goddamn hurry. Barrington adopted a conciliatory tone. We just finished supper, he said. You want something? Marianne can make up a tray. Steve's stomach was knotted with tension, but Harvey would surely have wanted supper, and Steve needed to appear as natural as possible. So he pretended to soften and said, Sure, I'll have something. Barrington shouted, Marianne! After a moment, a pretty nervous-looking black girl appeared at the door. Bring Harvey some supper on a tray, Barrington said. Right away, monsieur, she said quietly. Steve watched her go, noting that she went through the living room on her way to the kitchen. Presumably the dining room was also that way, unless they ate in the kitchen. Proust leaned forward and said, Well, my boy, what did you learn? Steve had invented a fictional plan of action for Jeannie. I guess you can relax, for the moment at least, he said. Jeannie Ferrami intends to take legal action against Jones Falls University for wrongful dismissal. She thinks she will be able to cite the existence of the clones during that proceeding. Until then, she has no plans for publicity. She has an appointment with a lawyer on Wednesday. The three older men looked relieved. Proust said, A wrongful dismissal suit. That will take at least a year. We have plenty of time to do what we need to do. Fooled you, you malevolent old bastards. Barrington said, What about the Lisa Hoxton case? She knows who I am, and she thinks I did it, but she has no proof. She will probably accuse me, but I believe it will be seen as a wild accusation by a vengeful former employee. He nodded. That's good, but you still need a lawyer. You know what we'll do? You'll stay here tonight. It's too late to drive back to Philadelphia anyway. I don't want to spend the night here. I don't know. You'll come to the press conference with me in the morning, and right afterward we'll go see Henry Quinn. It's too risky. Don't panic. Think. If I stayed here, I would know exactly what these three creeps are up to at any moment. That's worth a degree of risk. I guess nothing much can happen while I'm asleep. I could sneak a call to Jeannie to let her know what's going on. He made a split-second decision. Okay, he said. Proust said, Well, we've been sitting here worrying ourselves to death for nothing. Bark was not quite so quick to accept the good news. He said suspiciously, It didn't occur to the girl to try and sabotage the takeover of Genetico? She's smart, but I don't think she's business-minded, Steve said. Proust winked and said, What's she like in the sack, eh? Feisty, Steve said with a grin, and Proust roared with laughter. Marianne came in with a tray, sliced chicken, a salad with onions, bread, and a Budweiser. Steve smiled at her. Thank you, he said. This looks great. She gave him a startled look, and Steve realized Harvey probably did not say thank you very often. He caught the eye of Preston Bark, who was frowning. Careful, careful. Don't spoil it now. You've got them where you want them. All you have to do is get through the next hour or so until bedtime. He started to eat. Bark said, Do you remember me taking you to the Plaza Hotel in New York for lunch when you were 10 years old? Steve was about to say yes when he caught the trace of a puzzled frown on Barrington's face. Is this a test? Is Bark suspicious? The plaza? He said with a frown. Either way, he could give only one answer. Gee, Uncle Preston, I don't remember that. Maybe it was my sister's boy, Bark said. Phew. Barrington got up. All that beer is making me piss like a horse, he said. He went out. I need a scotch, Proust said. Steve said, try the bottom drawer of the file cabinet. That's where Dad usually keeps it. Proust went to the cabinet and opened the drawer. Well done, boy, he said. He took out the bottle and some glasses. I've known about that hiding place since I was 12 years old, Steve said. That was when I started stealing it. Proust roared with laughter. Steve stole a glance at Bark. The wary look had gone from his face, and he was smiling. 60. Mr. Oliver produced an enormous pistol he had kept from World War II. Took it off a German prisoner, he said. Colored soldiers weren't generally allowed to carry firearms in those days. He sat on Jeannie's couch, pointing the gun at Harvey. Lisa was on the phone, trying to find George DeSalt. Jeannie said, I'm going to check myself into the hotel and reconnoiter. She put a few things into a suitcase and drove to the Stouffer Hotel, thinking about how they would get Harvey to a room without attracting the attention of hotel security. The Stouffer had an underground garage. That was a good start. She left her car there and took the elevator. It went only to the lobby, not to the rooms, she observed. To get to the rooms, you had to take another elevator. But all elevators were grouped together in a passageway off the main lobby, not visible from the reception desk, and it would take only a few seconds to cross the passage from the garage elevator to the room elevator. Would they be carrying Harvey, or dragging him, or would he be cooperative and walk? She found it difficult to envisage. She checked in, went to her room, put down her suitcase, then left immediately and drove back to her apartment. I reached George DeSalt, Lisa said excitedly as soon as she walked in. That's great. Where? I found his mother in Buffalo, and she gave me his number in New York. He's an actor in a play, off Broadway. Will he come tomorrow? Yes. I'll do anything for publicity, he said. I fixed up his flight and said I'd meet him at the airport. That's wonderful. We'll have 3 clones. It will look incredible on TV. If we can get Harvey into the hotel... Jeannie turned to Mr. Oliver. We can avoid the hotel doorman by driving into the underground garage. The garage elevator goes only as far as the ground floor of the hotel. You have to get out there and get another elevator to the rooms. But the elevator bank is kind of concealed. Mr. Oliver said dubiously, All the same, we're going to have to keep him quiet for a good 5, maybe 10 minutes while we get him from the car to the room. And what if some of the hotel guests see him all tied up? They might ask questions, or call security. Jeannie looked at Harvey, lying bound and gagged on the floor. He was watching them and listening. I've been thinking about this, and I have some ideas, Jeannie said. Can you retie his feet so he can walk, but not very fast? Sure. While Mr. Oliver was doing that, Jeannie went into her bedroom. From her closet, she took a colorful sarong she had bought for the beach, a big wraparound shawl, a handkerchief, and a Nancy Reagan mask she had been given at a party and had forgotten to throw away. Mr. Oliver was getting Harvey to his feet. As soon as he was upright, Harvey took a swing at Mr. Oliver with his bound hands. Jeannie gasped and Lisa screamed, but Mr. Oliver seemed to have been expecting it. He dodged the blow easily, then hit Harvey in the stomach with the butt of the gun. Harvey grunted and bent double, and Mr. Oliver hit him with the gun butt again. This time on his head. Harvey sank to his knees. Mr. Oliver hauled him up again. Now he seemed docile. I want to dress him up, Jeannie said.
You go ahead, Mr. Oliver said. I'll just stand by and hurt him now and again to keep him cooperative.
Nervously, Jeannie wrapped the sarong around Harvey's waist and tied it like a skirt. Her hands were unsteady. She hated being this close to him. The skirt was long and covered Harvey's ankles, concealing the length of electrical cable that hobbled him. She draped the shawl over his shoulders and fastened it with a safety pin to the bonds on Harvey's wrists, so that he looked as if he were clutching the corners of the shawl like an old lady. Next, she rolled the handkerchief and tied it across his open mouth, securing it with a knot behind his neck so that the dishcloth could not fall out. Finally, she put on the Nancy Reagan mask to hide the gag. "He's been to a costume party, dressed as Nancy Reagan, and he's drunk," she said. "That's pretty good," Mr. Oliver said. The phone rang. Jeannie picked it up. "Hello? This is Mish Delaware." Jeannie had forgotten about her. It had been 14 or 15 hours since she had been desperate to contact her. "Hi," she said. "You were right. Harvey Jones did it."
"How do you know?"
"The Philadelphia police were quick off the mark. They went to his apartment. He wasn't there, but a neighbor let them in. They found a hat and realized it was the one in the description."
"That's great! I'm ready to arrest him, but I don't know where he is."
"Do you?" Jeannie looked at him, dressed like a 6'2" Nancy Reagan.
"No idea," she said, "but I can tell you where he'll be at noon tomorrow."
"Go on."
"Regency Room, Stouffer Hotel, at a press conference."
"Thanks."
"Mish, do me a favor."
"What?"
"Don't arrest him until the press conference is over. It's really important to me that he's there."
She hesitated, then said,
"Okay. Thanks. I appreciate it."
Jeannie hung up.
"Okay, let's get him in the car."
Mr. Oliver said, "You go ahead and open the doors. I'll bring him."
Jeannie picked up her keys and ran downstairs into the street. Night had fallen, but there was bright starlight as well as the shadowy illumination of the streetlights. She looked along the street. A young couple in ripped jeans were strolling in the opposite direction, hand in hand. On the other side of the road, a man in a straw hat was walking a yellow Labrador. They would all be able to see clearly what was going on. Would they look? Would they care? Jeannie unlocked her car and opened the door. Harvey and Mr. Oliver came out of the house, very close together, Mr. Oliver pushing his prisoner forward, Harvey stumbling. Lisa followed them, closing the door of the house. For an instant, the scene struck Jeannie as absurd. Hysterical laughter bubbled up into her throat. She put her fist in her mouth to silence it. Harvey reached the car, and Mr. Oliver gave a final shove. Harvey half fell into the back seat. Jeannie's moment of hilarity passed. She looked again at the other people in the street. The man in the straw hat was watching his dog urinate on the tire of a Subaru. The young couple had not turned around. So far, so good.
"I'll get in the back with him," Mr. Oliver said.
"Okay." Lisa got in the front passenger seat, and Jeannie drove. Downtown was quiet on Sunday night. She entered the parking garage beneath the hotel and parked as close as possible to the elevator shaft to minimize the distance they had to drag Harvey. The garage was not deserted. They had to wait in the car while a dressed-up couple got out of a Lexus and went up to the hotel. Then, when there was no one to see, they got out of the car. Jeannie took a wrench from her trunk, showed it to Harvey, then tucked it into the pocket of her blue jeans. Mr. Oliver had his wartime pistol in his waistband, concealed by the tail of his shirt. They pulled Harvey out of the car. Jeannie expected him to turn violent at any moment, but he walked peaceably to the elevator. It took a long time to arrive. When it came, they bundled him in, and Jeannie pressed the button for the lobby. As they went up, Mr. Oliver punched Harvey in the stomach again. Jeannie was shocked. There had been no provocation. Harvey groaned and doubled over just as the doors were opening. Two men waiting for the elevator stared at Harvey. Mr. Oliver led him stumbling out, saying, "Excuse me, gentlemen. This young man has had one drink too many." They got out of the way smartly. Another elevator stood waiting. They got Harvey into it, and Jeannie pressed the button for the 8th floor. She sighed with relief as the doors closed. They rode to their floor without incident. Harvey was recovering from Mr. Oliver's punch, but they were almost at their destination. Jeannie led the way to the room she had taken. As they got there, she saw with dismay that the door was open, and hanging on the doorknob was a card saying, "Room being serviced." The maid must be turning down the bed or something. Jeannie groaned. Suddenly, Harvey began to thrash around, making noises of protest in his throat, swinging wildly with his bound hands.
Mr. Oliver tried to hit him, but he dodged and took 3 steps along the corridor. Jeannie stooped in front of him, grabbed the cord binding his ankles with both hands, and heaved. Harvey stumbled. Jeannie tugged again, this time with no effect. God, he's heavy. He raised his hands to strike her. She braced herself and pulled with all her might. His feet flew from under him, and he went down with a crash. My goodness, what in heaven's name is going on? Said a prim voice. The maid, a black woman of about 60, in an immaculate uniform, had stepped out of the room. Mr. Oliver knelt at Harvey's head and lifted his shoulders. This young man been partying too hard, he said. Threw up all over the hood of my limousine. I get it. He's our driver, just for the maid's benefit. Partying, said the maid. Looked more like fighting to me. Speaking to Jeannie, Mr. Oliver said, Could you lift his feet, ma'am? Jeannie did so. They lifted Harvey. He wriggled. Mr. Oliver appeared to drop him, but put his knee in the way so that Harvey fell on it and was winded. Be careful. You'll hurt him, the maid said. Once more, ma'am, Mr. Oliver said. They picked him up and carried him into the room. They dumped him on the nearer of the 2 beds. The maid followed them in. I hope he ain't going to throw up in here. Mr. Oliver smiled at her. Now, how come I've never seen you around here before? I have an eye for a pretty girl, but I don't recall noticing you. Don't be fresh, she said, but she was smiling. I ain't no girl. I'm 71, and you can't be a day over 45. I'm 59, too old to listen to your jive. He took her arm and gently led her out of the room, saying, Hey, I'm almost through with these folks. Do you want to go for a ride in my limousine? With puke all over it? No way. She cackled. I could get it cleaned up. I have a husband waiting for me at home, and if he could hear you talking now, there'd be worse than puke on your hood, Mr. Limo. Uh-oh. Mr. Oliver put up his hands in a defensive gesture. I never meant no harm. Miming fear, he backed into the room and closed the door. Jeannie fell into a chair. God Almighty, we did it, she said. 61. As soon as Steve had finished eating, he stood up and said, I need to turn in. He wanted to retire to Harvey's room as soon as possible. When he was alone, he would be safe from discovery. The party broke up. Proust swallowed the rest of his scotch, and Barrington walked the 2 guests to their cars. Steve saw an opportunity to call Jeannie and tell her what was going on. He snatched up the phone and called information. They took a long time to answer. Come on, come on! At last he got through and asked for the number of the hotel. He misdialed the first time and got some restaurant. Frantically, he dialed again and at last reached the hotel. I'd like to speak to Dr. Jean Ferrami, he said. Barrington came back into the den just as Steve heard her voice. Hello? Hi, Linda, this is Harvey, he said. Steve, is that you? Yeah, I've decided to stay over at my dad's place. It's a little late for a long drive. For God's sake, Steve, are you okay? Some business to take care of, but nothing I can't handle. How was your day, honey? We've got him into the hotel room. It wasn't easy, but we did it. Lisa contacted George DeSalt. He promised to come, so we should have 3 at least. Good. I'm going to bed now. I'm still hoping to see you tomorrow, honey, okay? Hey, good luck. You too. Good night. Barrington winked. Hot, babe. Warm. Barrington took out some pills and washed one down with scotch. Catching Steve's glance at the bottle, he explained. Dalmain, I need something to help me sleep after all this. Good night, Dad. Barrington put his arm around Steve's shoulders. Good night, son, he said. Don't worry. We'll come through all right. He really loves his rotten son, Steve thought, and for a moment he felt irrationally guilty for deceiving a fond father. Then he realized he did not know where his bedroom was. He left the den and took a few steps along the passage that he guessed led to the bedrooms. He had no idea which door led to Harvey's room. Looking back, he saw that Barrington could not watch him from the den. Quickly, he opened the nearest door, trying desperately to do so silently. It led to a full bathroom, with shower and tub. He closed it gently. Next to it was a closet full of towels and linens. He tried the door opposite. It opened into a big bedroom with a double bed and lots of closets. A pinstriped suit in a dry cleaner's bag hung from a doorknob. He did not think Harvey had a pinstriped suit. He was about to close the door softly when he was shocked to hear Barrington's voice right behind him. "You need something from my room?" He gave a guilty start. For a moment he was struck dumb. "What the hell can I say?" Then words came to him. "I don't have anything to sleep in." "Since when have you taken to wearing pajamas?" Barrington's voice could have been suspicious or merely puzzled. Steve could not tell. Improvising wildly, he said, "I thought you might have an oversized T-shirt." "Nothing that will fit those shoulders, my boy," Barrington said. And to Steve's relief, he laughed. Steve shrugged. "It doesn't matter." He moved on. At the end of the passage were two doors on opposite sides. Harvey's room and the maid's, presumably. But which is which? Steve loitered, hoping that Barrington would disappear into his own room before Steve had to make the choice. When he reached the end of the passage, he glanced back. Barrington was watching him. "Night, Dad," he said.
"Good night."
Left or right? No way to tell. Pick one at random. Steve opened the door on his right. Rugby shirt on the back of a chair. Snoop Doggy Dog CD on the bed. Playboy on the desk. A boy's room. Thank God. He stepped inside and closed the door behind him with his heel. He slumped against the door, weak with relief. After a moment, he undressed and got into bed, feeling very weird in Harvey's bed, in Harvey's room, in Harvey's father's home. He turned out the light and lay awake, listening to the sounds of the strange house. For a while, he heard footsteps, doors closing and taps running. Then the place was quiet. He dozed lightly and woke suddenly. There's someone else in the room. He caught a distinctive smell of some flowery perfume mixed with garlic and spices. Then he saw the outline of Marianne's small form cross the window. Before he could say anything, she was getting into bed with him. He whispered, "Hey! I'm going to blow you just the way you like," she said. But he could hear fear in her voice. "No," he said, pushing her away as she burrowed under the bedclothes toward his groin. She was naked. "Please don't hurt me tonight. Please, Harvey," she said. She had a French accent. Steve figured it out. Marianne was an immigrant, and Harvey had her so terrified that she not only did anything he asked, but also anticipated his demands. How did he get away with beating the poor girl when his father was in the next room? Didn't she make a noise? Then Steve remembered the sleeping pill. Barrington slept so heavily that Marianne's cries did not wake him. "I'm not going to hurt you, Marianne," he said. "Relax." She started kissing his face. "Be nice. Please be nice. I'll do everything you like, but don't hurt me." "Marianne," he said sternly, "be still." She froze. He put his arm around her thin shoulders. Her skin was soft and warm. "Just lie there a moment and calm down," he said, stroking her back. "Nobody is going to hurt you anymore. I promise." She was tense, expecting blows, but gradually she relaxed. She moved closer to him. He had an erection. He could not help it. He knew he could make love to her easily. Lying there, holding her small, trembling body, he was powerfully tempted. No one would ever know. How delightful it would be to stroke her and arouse her. She would be so surprised and pleased to be loved gently and considerately. They would kiss and touch all night. He sighed. But it would be wrong. She was not a volunteer. Insecurity and fear had brought her to this bed, not desire. "Yes, Steve. You can fuck her, and you will be exploiting a frightened immigrant who believes she has no choice, and that would be contemptible. You would despise a man who could do that." "Do you feel better now?" he said. "Yes." "Then go back to your own bed." She touched his face, then kissed his mouth softly. He kept his lips firmly shut, but patted her hair in a friendly way. She stared at him in the half dark. "You're not him, are you?" she said. "No," Steve said. "I'm not him." A moment later, she was gone. He still had an erection. Why am I not him? Because of the way I was brought up? Hell no. I could have fucked her. I could be Harvey. I'm not him because I choose not to be. My parents didn't make that decision just now. I did. Thanks for your help, Mom and Dad. But it was me, not you, who sent her back to her room. Barrington didn't create me, and you didn't create me. I did. Monday. 62. Steve woke up with a start. Where am I? Someone was shaking his shoulder. A man in striped pajamas. It was Barrington Jones. He suffered a moment of disorientation, then everything came back to him. Dress smart for the press conference, please, Barrington said. In the closet, you'll find a shirt you left here a couple of weeks ago. Marianne laundered it. Come to my room and pick out a tie to borrow. He went out. Barrington talked to his son as if to a difficult, disobedient child, Steve reflected as he got out of bed. The unspoken sentence, "Don't argue, just do it," was attached to every utterance. But his abrupt manner made conversation easier for Steve. He could get away with monosyllabic responses that did not risk betraying his ignorance. It was 8 a.m. Wearing his undershorts, he went along the passage to the bathroom. He took a shower, then shaved with a disposable razor he found in the bathroom cabinet. He moved slowly, postponing the moment when he would have to put himself at risk by conversing with Barrington. Wrapping a towel around his waist, he went to Barrington's room, in accordance with his orders. Barrington was not there. Steve opened the closet. Barrington's ties were baronial, stripes and small dots and foulards, all in shiny silk. Nothing up to date. He picked one with broad horizontal stripes. He needed underwear, too. He looked at Barrington's boxer shorts. Although he was much taller than Barrington, they had the same waist size. He took a plain blue pair. When he was dressed, he braced himself for another ordeal of deception. Just a few more hours and it would be all over. He had to allay Barrington's suspicions until a few minutes after noon, when Jeannie would interrupt the press conference. He took a deep breath and went out. He followed the smell of frying bacon to the kitchen. Marianne was at the stove. She stared wide-eyed at Steve. Steve had a momentary panic. If Barrington noticed her expression, he might ask her what was wrong, and the poor girl was so terrified that she would probably tell him. But Barrington was watching CNN on a small TV set, and he was not the type to take an interest in a help. Steve sat down, and Marianne poured him coffee and juice. He gave her a reassuring smile to calm her down. Barrington held up a hand for silence, unnecessarily, for Steve had no intention of making small talk, and the anchor read an item about the takeover of Genetico. Michael Madigan, CEO of Landsman North America, said last night that the disclosure phase had been satisfactorily completed, and the deal will be signed in public at a press conference in Baltimore today. Shares in Landsman rose 50 pfennigs on the Frankfurt Exchange in early trading this morning. General Motors, third quarter figures. There was a ring at the doorbell, and Barrington hit the mute button. He looked out of the kitchen window and said, "There's a police car outside." Steve was struck by a terrible thought. If Jeannie had reached Mish Delaware and told her what she had learned about Harvey, the police could have decided to arrest Harvey. And Steve was going to have trouble denying that he was Harvey Jones when he was wearing Harvey's clothes and sitting in Harvey's father's kitchen eating blueberry muffins made by Harvey's father's cook. He did not want to go back to jail. But that was not the worst of it. If he should be arrested now, he would miss the press conference. If none of the other clones showed up, Jeannie would have only Harvey. And one twin did not prove anything. Barrington got up to go to the door. Steve said, "What if they're after me?" Marianne looked as if she were going to die. Barrington said, "I'll tell them you're not here." He left the room. Steve could not hear the conversation on the doorstep. He sat frozen to his seat, neither eating nor drinking. Marianne stood like a statue at the stove, with a kitchen spatula in her hand. Eventually, Barrington came back in. "Three of our neighbors were robbed last night," he said. "I guess we got lucky." Through the night, Jeannie and Mr. Oliver had taken shifts, one guarding Harvey while the other lay down, but neither of them got much rest. Only Harvey slept, snoring behind his gag. In the morning, they took turns in the bathroom. Jeannie dressed in the clothes she had brought in her suitcase, a white blouse and black skirt, so that she could be taken for a waitress. They ordered breakfast from room service. They could not let the waiter into the room, for then he would see Harvey trussed up on the bed. So Mr. Oliver signed the check at the door, saying, "My wife's undressed. I'll take the trolley from here." He let Harvey drink a glass of orange juice, holding it to his mouth while Jeannie stood behind him, ready to hit him with her wrench if he tried anything. Jeannie waited anxiously for Steve to call. What had happened to him? He had spent the night at Barrington's house. Was he keeping up the pretense? Lisa arrived at 9 o'clock with a pile of copies of the press release, then left for the airport to meet George DeSalt and any other clones who might show up. None of the three had called. Steve called at 9:30. "I have to be quick," he said. "Barrington's in the bathroom. Everything's all right. I'm coming to the press conference with him." "He doesn't suspect anything?" "No, although I've had some tense moments. How's my double?" "Subdued." "Gotta go. Steve, make it fast. I love you." She hung up. "I shouldn't have said that. A girl is supposed to play hard to get." "Well, to hell with it." At 10, she went on a scouting expedition to check out the Regency room. It was a corner room with a little lobby and a door to an anteroom. A publicist was already there, assembling a backdrop with the Genetico logo for the benefit of the TV cameras. Jeannie took a swift look around, then returned to her room. Lisa called from the airport. "Bad news," she said. "The New York flight is late." "Oh, Christ," Jeannie said. "Any sign of the others, Wayne or Hank?" "No." "How late is George's plane?" "It's expected at 11:30. "You might still get here, if I drive like the wind." At 11 o'clock, Barrington emerged from his bedroom, pulling on his suit coat. He was wearing a blue chalk stripe with a vest over a white shirt with French cuffs. Old-fashioned, but effective. "Let's get going," he said. Steve put on Harvey's tweed sport coat. It fit perfectly, of course, and it looked a lot like one Steve himself owned. They went outside. They were both overdressed for this weather. They got into the silver Lincoln and turned on the air conditioning. Barrington drove fast, heading downtown. To Steve's relief, he did not talk much on the journey. He parked in the hotel garage. "Genetico hired a public relations outfit to run this event," he said as they went up in the elevator. "Our in-house publicity department has never handled anything this big." As they headed for the Regency room, a smartly coiffed woman in a black suit intercepted them. "I'm Karen Beamish from Total Communications," she said brightly. "Would you like to come to the VIP room?" She showed them into a small room where snacks and drinks were laid out. Steve was mildly bothered. He would have liked to take a look at the layout of the conference room. But perhaps it made no difference. As long as Barrington continued to believe he was Harvey right up until the appearance of Jeannie, nothing else mattered. There were 6 or 7 people in the VIP room already, including Proust and Bark. With Proust was a muscular young man in a black suit who looked like a bodyguard. Barrington introduced Steve to Michael Madigan, the head of Landsman's North American operations. Barrington nervously gulped a glass of white wine. Steve could have used a martini. He had much more reason to be scared than Barrington, but he had to keep his wits about him, and he could not afford to relax for an instant. He looked at the watch he had taken from Harvey's wrist. It was 11:55. "Just a few more minutes, and when this is over, then I'll have a martini." Karen Beamish clapped her hands for attention and said, "Gentlemen, are we ready?" There were muttered replies and nods. "Then everyone but the platform party should take their seats now, please." "That's it. I've succeeded. It's over." Barrington turned to Steve and said, "See you sooner, Montezuma." He looked expectant. "Sure," Steve said. Barrington grinned. "What do you mean, sure? Give me the rest of it." Steve went cold. He had no idea what Barrington was talking about. It seemed to be a catchphrase, like, "See you later, alligator," but a private one. Obviously, there was a reply, but it wasn't "in a while, crocodile." What the hell could it be? Steve cursed inwardly. The press conference was about to open. He needed to keep up the pretense for just a few more seconds. Barrington frowned in puzzlement, staring at him. Steve felt perspiration break out on his forehead.
You can't have forgotten it, Barrington said, and Steve saw suspicion dawn in his eyes. Of course I haven't, Steve replied quickly. Too quickly, for then he realized that he had committed himself. Senator Proust was listening now. Barrington said, so give me the rest of it. Steve saw him cut his eyes to Proust's bodyguard, and the man tensed visibly. In desperation, Steve said, in an hour, Eisenhower. There was a moment's silence. Then Barrington said, that's a good one, and laughed. Steve relaxed. That must be the game. You had to make up a new response every time. He thanked his stars. To hide his relief, he turned away. Showtime, everybody, said the publicist. This way, Proust said to Steve. You don't want to walk out onto the stage. He opened a door and Steve stepped through. He found himself in a bathroom. Turning around, he said, no, this is... Proust's bodyguard was right behind him. Before Steve knew what was happening, the man had him in a painful half-Nelson. Make a noise and I'll break your fucking arms, he said. Barrington stepped into the bathroom behind the bodyguard. Jim Proust followed him and closed the door. The bodyguard held the boy tightly. Barrington's blood was boiling. You young punk, he hissed. Which one are you? Steve Logan, I suppose. The boy tried to keep up the pretense. Dad, what are you doing? Forget it. The game's up. Now where is my son? The boy did not answer. Jim said, Barry, what the hell is going on? Barrington tried to calm down. This isn't Harvey, he said to Jim. This is one of the others, probably the Logan boy. He must have been impersonating Harvey since yesterday evening. Harvey himself must be locked away somewhere. Jim paled. That means that what he told us about Jeannie Ferrami's intentions was a blind. Barrington nodded grimly. She's probably planning some kind of protest at the press conference. Proust said, shit, not in front of all the cameras. That's what I'd do in her place, wouldn't you? Proust thought for a moment. Will Madigan keep his nerve? Barrington shook his head. I couldn't say. He'd look pretty foolish canceling the takeover at the last minute. On the other hand, he'd look even more foolish paying $180 million for a company that's about to be sued for every penny it's got. He could go either way. Then we've got to find Jeannie Ferrami and stop her. She might have checked into the hotel. Barrington snatched up the phone beside the toilet. This is Professor Jones at the Genetico press conference in the Regency room, he said in his most authoritative voice. We're waiting for Dr. Ferrami. What room is she in? I'm sorry, we're not allowed to give out room numbers, sir. Barrington was about to explode when she added, would you like me to connect you? Yes, sure. He heard the ringing tone. After a wait, it was answered by a man who sounded elderly. Improvising, Barrington said, your laundry is ready, Mr. Blenkinsop. I didn't give out no laundry. Oh, I'm sorry, sir. What room are you in? He held his breath. 821? I wanted 812. My apologies. No problem. Barrington hung up. They're in room 821, he said excitedly. I bet Harvey's there. Proust said, the press conference is about to start. We may be too late. Barrington hesitated, torn. He did not want to delay the announcement by a single second, but he needed to forestall whatever Jeannie was planning. After a moment, he said to Jim, why don't you go on stage with Madigan and Preston? I'll do my best to find Harvey and stop Jeannie Ferrami. Okay? Barrington looked at Steve. I'd be happier if I could take your security man with me, but we can't let Steve loose. The bodyguard said, no problem, sir. I can handcuff him to a pipe. Great. Do it. Barrington and Proust returned to the VIP room. Madigan looked curiously at them. Something wrong, gentlemen? Proust said. A minor security question, Mike. Barrington is going to handle it while we go ahead with our announcement. Madigan was not quite satisfied. Security? Barrington said. A woman I fired last week, Jean Ferrami, is in the hotel. She may pull some kind of stunt. I'm going to head her off at the pass. That was enough for him. Okay, let's get on with it.
Madigan, Bark, and Proust went into the conference room. The bodyguard came out of the bathroom. He and Barrington hurried out into the corridor and pressed the button to summon the elevator. Barrington was apprehensive and worried. He was not a man of action. Never had been. The kind of combat he was used to took place on college committees. He hoped he was not about to get in a fist fight. They went to the 8th floor and ran to the room 821. Barrington rapped on the door. A man's voice called. "Who is it?" Barrington said.
"Housekeeping."
"We're okay, thank you, sir. I need to check your bathroom, please.
Come back later."
"There's a problem, sir."
"I'm busy right now. Come back in an hour."
Barrington looked at the bodyguard. "Can you kick this door down?" The man looked pleased. Then he looked over Barrington's shoulder and hesitated. Following the direction of his glance, Barrington saw an elderly couple with shopping bags emerge from the elevator. They walked slowly along the corridor toward 821. Barrington waited while they passed. They stopped outside 830. The husband put down his shopping, searched for his key, fumbled it into the lock, and opened the door. At last, the couple disappeared into the room. The bodyguard kicked the door. The door frame cracked and splintered, but the door held. There was a sound of rapid footsteps from inside. He kicked it again, and it flew open. He rushed inside, and Barrington followed. They were brought up short by the sight of an elderly black man pointing a huge antiquated pistol at them.
"Stick up your hands! Shut that door! Get in here and lie face down! Or I'll shoot you both dead," the man said. "After the way you bust in here, ain't no jury in Baltimore going to convict me for killing you."
Barrington raised his hands. Suddenly, a figure catapulted off the bed. Barrington just had time to see that it was Harvey, with his wrists tied together and some kind of gag over his mouth. The old man swung the gun toward him. Barrington was terrified that his son was about to be shot. He cried out, "No!" The old man moved a fraction of a second too late. Harvey's bound arms knocked the pistol out of his hands. The bodyguard leaped for it and snatched it up from the carpet. Standing up, he pointed it at the old man. Barrington breathed again. The old man slowly raised his arms in the air. The bodyguard picked up the room phone.
"Hotel security to room 821, he said. "There's a guest here with a gun."
Barrington looked around the room. There was no sign of Jeannie. Jeannie emerged from the elevator wearing her white blouse and black skirt and carrying a tray of tea she had ordered from room service. Her heart was beating like a bass drum. Walking at a brisk, waitressy pace, she entered the Regency room. In the little lobby, two women with checklists sat behind tables. A hotel security guard stood near, chatting to them. Presumably, no one was supposed to get in without an invitation, but Jeannie was betting they would not question a waitress with a tray. She forced herself to smile at the guard as she headed for the inner door.
"Hey," he said.
She turned at the door.
"They have plenty of coffee and beverages in there."
"This is jasmine tea, a special request."
"Who for?"
She thought fast.
"Senator Proust."
She prayed he was there.
"Okay, go ahead."
She smiled again, opened the door, and walked into the conference room. At the far end, three men in suits were sitting behind a table on a raised dais. In front of them was a pile of legal documents. One of the men was making a formal speech. The audience consisted of about 40 people with notebooks, miniature cassette tape recorders, and handheld television cameras. Jeannie walked to the front. Standing beside the dais was a woman in a black suit and designer glasses. She wore a badge saying, "Karen Beamish, Total Communications." She was the publicist Jeannie had seen earlier, assembling the backdrop. She looked curiously at Jeannie but did not try to stop her, assuming, as Jeannie had intended, that someone had ordered something from room service. The men on the dais had name cards in front of them. She recognized Senator Proust on the right. On the left was Preston Bark. The one in the middle, who was speaking, was Michael Madigan. "Genetico is not just an exciting biotechnology company," he was saying in a boring tone. Jeannie smiled and put down the tray in front of him. He looked mildly surprised and stopped in his speech for a moment. Jeannie turned to the audience.
"I have a very special announcement," she said.
End of side 10. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over. Side 11. The Third Twin by Ken Follett. Continuing on page 413. Steve was sitting on the bathroom floor with his left hand handcuffed to the drainpipe of the bathroom wash basin, feeling angry and desperate. Barrington had found him out a few seconds before his time ran out. Now he was searching for Jeannie and might ruin the entire plan if he found her. Steve had to get away to warn her. The pipe was attached at its top end to the drain of the basin. It turned in an S-bend, then disappeared into the wall. Contorting his body, Steve got his foot on the pipe, drew it back, and kicked. The entire plumbing fitting shuddered. He kicked again. The mortar around the pipe where it entered the wall began to crumble. He kicked several more times. The mortar fell away, but the pipe was strong. Frustrated, he peered up to where the pipe joined the wash basin. Maybe that join was weaker. He grasped the pipe with both hands and shook it frenziedly. Once again, everything trembled, but nothing broke. He looked at the S-bend. There was a knurled collar around the pipe just above the bend. Plumbers unscrewed it when they had to clean out the bend, he knew, but they used a tool. He got his left hand to the collar, gripped it as hard as he could, and tried to turn it. His finger slipped, and he grazed his knuckles painfully. He tapped the underside of the sink. It was made of some kind of artificial marble, quite strong. He looked again at the place where the pipe connected with the drain. If he could break that seal, he might be able to pull the pipe out. Then he could easily slip the handcuff over the end and be free. He changed his position, drew back his foot, and started kicking again. Jeannie said, 23 years ago, Genetico carried out illegal and irresponsible experiments on 8 unsuspecting American women. Her breath was coming fast, and she struggled to speak normally and project her voice. All the women were wives of army officers. She searched the audience for Steve, but could not see him. Where the hell was he? He was supposed to be here. He was the proof. Karen Beamish said in a shaky voice, "This is a private function. Please leave immediately." Jeannie ignored her. The women went to Genetico's clinic in Philadelphia to have hormone treatment for subfertility. She let her anger show. Without permission, they were impregnated with embryos from total strangers. There was a buzz of comment from the assembled journalists. They were interested. Jeannie could tell. She raised her voice. Preston Bark, supposedly a responsible scientist, was so obsessed with his pioneering work in cloning that he divided an embryo 7 times, producing 8 identical embryos, and implanted them in 8 unsuspecting women. Jeannie spotted Mish Delaware sitting at the back, watching with an expression of faint amusement. But Barrington was not in the room. That was surprising and worrying. On the platform, Preston Bark stood up and spoke. "Ladies and gentlemen, I apologize for this. We were warned there might be a disturbance." Jeannie plowed on. "This outrage has been kept secret for 23 years. The 3 perpetrators, Preston Bark, Senator Proust, and Professor Barrington Jones, have been prepared to go to any lengths to cover it up, as I know from bitter experience." Karen Beamish was speaking into a hotel phone. Jeannie heard her say, "Get some goddamn security in here right away, please." Under the tray, Jeannie had been carrying a sheaf of copies of the press release that she had written and Lisa had photocopied. "All the details are in this handout," she said, and she began to pass them around as she continued speaking. "Those 8 alien embryos grew and were born, and 7 of them are alive today. You'll know them because they all look alike." She could tell from the journalist's expressions that she had them where she wanted them. A glance at the platform showed Proust with a face like thunder and Preston Bark looking as if he wanted to die. About now, Mr. Oliver was supposed to walk in with Harvey so that everyone could see he looked just like Steve and possibly George DeSalt as well. But there was no sign of any of them. "Don't leave it too late." Jeannie carried on speaking. "You would think they were identical twins, and in fact they have identical DNA. But they were born to 8 different mothers. I study twins, and the puzzle of the twins who had different mothers was what first started me investigating this shameful story." The door at the back of the room burst open.
Jeannie looked up, hoping to see one of the clones. But it was Barrington who rushed in. Breathlessly, as if he had been running, Barrington said, "Ladies and gentlemen, this lady is suffering from a nervous breakdown and has lately been dismissed from her job. She was a researcher on a project funded by Genetico and bears the company a grudge. Hotel security has just arrested an accomplice of hers on another floor. Please bear with us while they escort this person from the building. Then our press conference can resume." Jeannie was knocked for a loop. Where were Mr. Oliver and Harvey, and what had happened to Steve? Her speech and her handout meant nothing without evidence. She had only a few seconds left. Something had gone terribly wrong. Barrington had somehow foiled her plan. A uniformed security guard strode into the room and spoke to Barrington. In desperation, Jeannie turned to Michael Madigan. He had a frosty look on his face, and she guessed he was the kind of man who hated interruptions to his smoothly organized routine. All the same, she tried. "I see you have the legal papers in front of you, Mr. Madigan," she said. "Don't you think you should check out this story before you sign? Just suppose I'm right. Imagine how much money those 8 women could sue you for." Madigan said mildly, "I'm not in the habit of making business decisions based on tip-offs from nutcases." The journalist laughed, and Barrington began to look more confident. The security guard approached Jeannie. She said to the audience, "I was hoping to show you 2 or 3 of the clones by way of proof, but they haven't showed up." The reporters laughed again, and Jeannie realized she had become a joke. It was all over, and she had lost. The guard took her firmly by the arm and pushed her toward the door. She could have fought him off, but there was no point. She passed Barrington and saw him smile. She felt tears come to her eyes, but she swallowed them and held her head high. "To hell with you all," she thought. "One day you'll find out I was right." Behind her, she heard Karen Beamish say, "Mr. Madigan, if you would care to resume your remarks." As Jeannie and the guard reached the door, it opened, and Lisa came in. Jeannie gasped when she saw that right behind her was one of the clones. It must be George DeSalt. He had come, but one was not enough. She needed 2 to make her point. If only Steve would show up, or Mr. Oliver with Harvey. Then, with blinding joy, she saw a second clone walk in. It must be Henry King. She shook off the security guard. "Look," she yelled. "Look here." As she spoke, a third clone walked in. The black hair told her it was Wayne Statner. "See," Jeannie yelled. "Here they are. They're identical." All the cameras swung away from the platform and pointed at the newcomers. Lights flashed as photographers began to snap the incident. "I told you," Jeannie said triumphantly to the journalists. "Now ask them about their parents. They're not triplets. Their mothers have never met. Ask them. Go on. Ask them." She realized she was sounding too excited, and she made an effort to calm down. But it was difficult. She felt so happy. Several reporters leaped up and approached the 3 clones, eager to question them. The guard took Jeannie's arm again, but she was now at the center of a crowd and could not move anyway. In the background, she heard Barrington raise his voice over the buzz of the reporters. "Ladies and gentlemen, if we could have your attention, please." He began by sounding angry, but soon became petulant. "We would like to continue with a press conference." It was no good. The pack had scented a real story, and they had lost interest in speeches. Out of the corner of her eye, Jeannie saw Senator Proust slip quietly out of the room. A young man thrust a microphone at her and said, "How did you find out about these experiments?" Jeannie said into the microphone, "My name is Dr. Jean Ferrami, and I'm a scientist at Jones Falls University, in the psychology department. In the course of my work, I came across this group of people who seem to be identical twins but aren't related. I investigated. Barrington Jones attempted to have me fired to prevent my finding out the truth. Despite that, I discovered the clones were the result of a military experiment conducted by Genetico." She looked around the room. Where was Steve? Steve gave one more kick, and the drain pipe sprang away from the underside of the wash basin in a shower of mortar and marble chips. Heaving on the pipe, He pulled it away from the sink and slipped the handcuff through the gap. Freed, he got to his feet. He put his left hand in his pocket to conceal the handcuff that dangled from his wrist. Then he left the bathroom. The VIP room was empty. Not sure what he might find in the conference room, he stepped out into the corridor. Next to the VIP room was a door marked Regency Room. Farther along the corridor, waiting for the elevator, was one of his doubles. Who was it? The man was rubbing his wrists as if they were sore, and he had a red mark across both cheeks that looked as if it might have been made by a tight gag. This was Harvey, who had spent the night tied up. He looked up and caught Steve's eye. They stared at one another for a long moment. It was like looking into a mirror. Steve tried to see beyond Harvey's appearance, read his face and look into his heart, and see the cancer that made him evil. But he could not. All he saw was a man just like himself, who had walked down the same road and taken a different turning. He tore his eyes away from Harvey and went into the Regency room. It was pandemonium. Jeannie and Lisa were in the center of a crowd of cameramen. He saw one, no, two, three clones with them. He pushed through to her. "Jeannie," he said. She looked up at him, her face blank. "It's Steve," he said. Mish Delaware was beside her. Steve said to Mish, "If you're looking for Harvey, he's outside, waiting for the elevator." Mish said to Jeannie, "Can you tell which one this is?" "Sure." Jeannie looked at him and said, "I play a little tennis myself." He grinned. "If you only play a little tennis, you're probably not in my league." "Thank God," she said. She threw her arms around him. He smiled and bent to her face, and they kissed. The cameras swung around to them. A sea of flash guns glittered, and that was the picture on the front page of newspapers all over the world the following morning. Next June, 63. Forest Lawns was like a genteel, old-fashioned hotel. It had flowered wallpaper and china knick-knacks in glass cases, and occasional tables with spindly legs. It smelled of potpourri, not disinfectant, and the staff called Jeannie's mother Mrs. Farami, not Maria or dear. Mom had a little suite with a small parlor where visitors could sit and have tea. "This is my husband, Mom," Jeannie said, and Steve gave his most charming smile and shook her hand. "What a nice-looking boy," Mom said. "What work do you do, Steve?" "I'm studying law." "Law, that's a good career." She had flashes of rationality interspersed with longer periods of confusion. Jeannie said, "Daddy came to our wedding." "How is your father?" "He's good. He's too old to rob people anymore, so he protects them instead. He started his own security firm. It's doing well." "I haven't seen him for 20 years. "Yes, you have, Mom. He visits you, but you forget." Jeannie changed the subject. "You look well." Her mother was wearing a pretty cotton shirtwaist with a candy stripe. Her hair was permed and her nails were manicured. "Do you like it here? It's better than Bella Vista, don't you think?" Mom began to look worried. "How are we going to pay for it, Jeannie? I don't have any money." "I have a new job, Mom. I can afford it." "What job is that?" Jeannie knew she would not understand, but she told her anyway. "I'm director of genetics research for a big company called Landsman." Michael Madigan had offered her the job after someone explained her search engine to him. The salary was 3 times what she had been making at Jones Falls. Even more exciting was the work, which was at the leading edge of genetics research. "That's nice," Mom said. "Oh, before I forget, there was a picture of you in the newspaper. I saved it." She delved into her handbag and brought out a folded clipping. She straightened it out and gave it to Jeannie. Jeannie had seen it before, but she studied it as if it were new to her. It showed her at the congressional inquiry into the experiments at the Aventine Clinic. The inquiry had not yet produced its report, but there was not much doubt what it would say. The questioning of Jim Proust, televised nationwide, had been a public humiliation such as never been seen before. Proust had blustered and shouted and lied, and with every word, his guilt had become plainer. When it was over, he had resigned as a senator.
Barrington Jones had not been allowed to resign, but had been dismissed from Jones Falls by the discipline committee. Jeannie had heard he had moved to California, where he was living on a small allowance from his ex-wife. Preston Bark had resigned as president of Genetico, which had been liquidated to pay agreed compensation to the 8 mothers of the clones. A small sum had been set aside to pay for counseling to help each of the clones deal with his troubled history. And Harvey Jones was serving 5 years for arson and rape. Mom said, "The paper says you had to testify. You weren't in any kind of trouble, were you?" Jeannie exchanged a smile with Steve. "For a week, back in September, I was kind of in trouble, Mom. But it worked out all right in the end." "That's good." Jeannie stood up. "We have to go now. It's our honeymoon. We have a plane to catch." "Where are you going?" "A little resort in the Caribbean. People say it's the most beautiful place in the whole world." Steve shook Mom's hand, and Jeannie kissed her goodbye. "Have a good rest, honey," Mom said as they left. "You deserve it." Acknowledgements. I am deeply grateful to the following people for their kind help with the research for the third twin. In the Baltimore City Police Department, Lieutenant Frederick Tabor, Lieutenant Larry Leeson, Sergeant Sue Young, Detective Alexis Russell, Detective Aaron Stewart, Detective Andrea Nolan, Detective Leonard Douglas. In the Baltimore County Police Department, Sergeant David Moxley and Detective Karen Gentry. Court Commissioner Cheryl Alston, Judge Barbara Bear Waxman, Assistant State's Attorney Mark Cohen. Carol Kimmel, RN, at Mercy Hospital. Professor Trish Van Zandt and her colleagues at Johns Hopkins University. Ms. Bonnie Ariano, Executive Director of the Sexual Assault and Domestic Violence Center in Baltimore. At the University of Minnesota, Professor Thomas Bouchard, Professor Matthew McGue, Professor David Lycan. At the Pentagon, Lieutenant Colonel Letwich, Captain Reginor. At Fort Detrick in Frederick, Maryland, Ms. Eileen Mitchell, Mr. Chuck Daisy, Colonel David Franz. Peter D. Martin of the Metropolitan Police Forensic Science Laboratory. Computer experts Wade Chambers, Rob Cook, and Alan Gold. And especially professional researcher Dan Starer of Research for Writers, New York City, who put me in touch with most of the above people. I am also grateful to my editors, Suzanne Barbineau, Marjorie Chapman, and Anne Patty, to friends and family who read drafts of the book and made comments, including Barbara Follett, Emanuele Follett, Katya Follett, Jan Turner, Kim Turner, John Evans, George Brennan, and Ken Burroughs. To agents Amy Burkauer, Bob Bookman, and, most of all, my oldest collaborator and sharpest critic, Al Zuckerman. End of The Third Twin by Ken Follett. Read by Madeline Bazard in the studios of the American Printing House for the Blind, Louisville, Kentucky, for the Library of Congress, May 1997. Published by Crown Publishers, Incorporated, 201 East 50th Street, New York, New York, 10022. Further reproduction or distribution in other than a specialized format is prohibited. If you found any cassette in this book to be defective, please place a rubber band or piece of string around that cassette for identification. Place it in the container on top of the front stack of cassettes.